You're listening to a 95BFM podcast. You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lillian Hanley tōku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki Te Wire mo tēnei rā, kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 4th of September. We are in, September. Sorry. I'm joined in studio by Alan Blackman and Tu Whenua Rua. We are going to be joined soon by William Boyd. In September. This is weird. We're close to the end of the year. Anyway, I'm Lillian. I'll be with you for the next hour mumbling over my words. And on the show today, we have Dear Science with AUT's Alan Blackman. And we're talking about fluoride, which could get a little bit controversial, I think. We're talking minerals, never before seen in nature. And Pluto, is it now a planet again? We also have Helen Clark on the show. She speaks to us about the report released by the Helen Clark Foundation today around the decriminalisation of cannabis and voting yes in the 2020 referendum. William Boyd speaks to Dr. Lara Greaves about political donations and speaks to Philanthropy New Zealand Chief Exec Sue McCabe about severe government underfunding of essential social services. Koe wareware a hea na koutou te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō hei pakihere rokiroki. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website after the show. If you want to share your thoughts with us, particularly about fluoride or the decriminalisation of cannabis, tuku pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395. Waia mai rānei, you can give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Let's get into it.
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Oh wow. Alan, what do you have for us today?
Well, goodness me, fluoride and cannabis on the same show. I know which one's going to be more controversial. Absolutely no doubt about that whatsoever.
Now, this seems very serious. You gave us three articles for this.
I did.
Tells me that, I mean, I've been on the show 2 years, actually. It's my 2-year anniversary this week.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
happy
by the way.
Anniversary, wow.
So I know you, I feel like I know you well, and three articles for one topic means we're taking this seriously.
Yes, indeed it does. Okay, so I got rung up by the TV people on Monday and asked to give a comment about a paper that has been recently published on fluoride. And so I thought, what the heck, let's have a chat about it on this. And so, okay, without further ado, the title of the paper is Association Between Maternal Fluoride Exposure During Pregnancy and IQ Scores in Offspring in Canada.
Okay, let's start with what is fluoride? Do we need to start there? Where are you going to start?
I think everybody knows. Well, hopefully everybody knows what fluoride is. Hopefully everybody knows that it's a fact that fluoride lowers dental caries decay. Okay, so
it's good for your teeth. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. Okay. Yes. Yeah. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Okay. However, what people object to, I guess, is the whole mass medication thing. And I think they want to be able to choose whether or not they
had fluoride,
basically. And you've obviously got fluoride toothpaste and stuff and everything. So, you know, that's a potential source of fluoride as well. So, this paper that has just been published purports to show a link between people living in fluoridated water areas and a decrease in the IQ of their kids age 3 to 4.
Okay.
Okay.
Why do you say purports to show?
Well, it... okay. As the great Ernest Rutherford once said, that if your experiment relies on statistics, then you need a better experiment. Okay, so this is one of those things that we quite often talk about on Dear Science. It's an experiment that contains a human factor.
Uh-huh.
And experiments that contain human factors are problematic because of the fact that you've got an almost unlimited number of variables out there. And you're trying to pin effects on one of those particular, you know, zillions of variables and say, right, this effect is due to this particular variable. And that to me is damn near almost impossible. Okay, I find that really difficult. Okay, so this particular paper, the thing about it is that it's been published in a very good journal. Okay, now normally, what we find with questions of this type, let's say, is that often studies are published in journals that are less than wonderful, let's say, less than stellar. And so therefore that immediately brings to question the science. How good is the science that they're actually doing to come up with their proposals? And so this particular paper was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Pediatrics. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's an excellent journal. That's a top rating journal for pediatrics worldwide. Okay, so no doubt about that. Now, this paper was published with an editor's note as well, and that is a very, very rare thing to happen. I think this was the first editor's note that this particular editor had actually written, justifying its publication, saying that, whoa, yes, they realise that, yes, this is going to be controversial, absolutely. And with the interest of science at heart, they decided to publish it so that it could be put out there and discussed.
Wow.
Okay.
Okay, wait, when you say the interests of science, they're putting it out there to be discussed.
Yeah, well, you know, these are the results that these people have got. Okay,
and, so they're putting it out there so that people can be like, okay, this is this, maybe we should do another experiment, or...
Exactly, okay. So what has happened is that, yep, this paper has been published, and again, as I say, what the authors say that it shows is a link between lower IQ and having fluoride in your water. Okay. So, what...
Even that sentence in itself is a big call.
Well, okay, so this was reported on Scoop as a press release by the New Zealand Fluoride Coalition or something, basically saying that fluoride lowers your kid's IQ. Now, I think I'm quoting that almost verbatim, but if I'm not, forgive me, but it was put out as something that is not really factual. Okay, and that's the bit that pisses me off.
Right.
Okay. Yes, this is published in a good journal. However, there has been in the past, there's been crap science published in good journals, and the number one example of that, dare I say it, is the good old measles, mumps, rubella vaccine linked to autism.
Right.
Okay. That was published in the Lancet. The Lancet is an excellent medical journal. It should never have been published, okay? And people, and now we're reaping that. Now look at the measles epidemic that's in New Zealand now. People don't vaccinate their kids because of that paper, that flawed paper, okay?
Okay, so we're going back to the editor's note, right, in the sense that they've put it out there so that conversation is had.
Yes.
Okay, what the danger is, you're saying, is that the effects that could, or the consequences that could happen in the meantime while something else comes out to kind of disprove that, or?
Well, okay, so what are the consequences going to be? Well, the consequences have already been. Okay, this paper is out now, and it has been widely reported on. And so my bet is that any pregnant woman out there has probably stopped drinking water from the tap as a result of this. And, you know, of course, people are going to err on the side of caution. Of course they are.
Mm.
You know, absolutely, absolutely, definitely. So,
okay, and then, sorry.
Yeah, no.
Well, if this person does decide to stop drinking the water, we are lucky enough, I mean, one, to have water coming from our taps.
Amen.
Two, we can also go and source water elsewhere, I suppose.
Yes.
So, like you said before, there is that, the idea of choice, in the sense that people just wanted to have the choice of not having fluoride, I suppose, in their water.
Yes.
Yeah. So what's the harm there if people then make
decision? This is a long-standing debate. You know, this has been going on for many, many, many years. And people on both sides are totally entrenched, and I'm sorry, you know, people, you're not going to change people's minds in a hurry. Okay, so the people who are at the very extremes of all of this, who are usually the ones who make the most noise, unfortunately, they're not going to get through to each other and change anybody's mind. And so you've got everybody else in the middle. You've got the general populace in the middle thinking, shit, you know, which is right? Who do I believe?
Mm.
Now, the problems or the possible problems with this paper are quite a few. Okay, so it doesn't look like irreproachable science or irrefutable science, I would say. Okay. Now, having said that, I am no expert in the field that this paper discusses. Okay. Absolutely not. Now, there's a heavy statistics bent in this. It relies, these results rely on the statistics of the data that have been collected. Okay. So the first question you ask is, how good are the data? Okay. Have they been collected correctly? You will find experts, and I use this word advisedly, experts, people who do this stuff for a living, okay? People whose job it is to, you know, study pediatrics, study statistics, all of that sort of stuff. And they have come along and said, look, there seem to be problems with this. They haven't maybe sampled correctly, or they haven't analyzed the fluoride correctly. They've been getting these unusual results. In other words, the boys seem to be affected more than the girls, and that's extremely unusual, and there's no obvious explanation of why that might be the case. Okay, so my beef is with the science here. Okay. Now I'm not going to say yay or nay either side. Okay, I'm that's not my job, but my job is to maybe just tell everybody who may have heard about this paper to go and have a look at the Science Media Centre, which is a wonderful resource, which provides expert opinions on matters scientific.
Because that's what you're saying, right, is that, of course, somebody, especially like a pregnant mother who sees that, is going to be like, okay, I'm probably not going to drink the water. And that's like erring on the side of caution, making a safe call until we know more.
Yes.
And in that sense, on the kind of long-term ongoing conversation that we have to have about all issues, I suppose, what you're saying is try and be as informed as possible.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, it always comes back to that. But, and then sadly, the extremists on either side then try and inform you, you know, one way
or another
or the other. And the just doesn't seem to be any middle ground on all of this sort of stuff. And that's the really, really sad thing. So I'm sure we will probably hear a lot more about this paper. I've already, as a result of being on TV, I've already had a couple of emails from certain interested parties berating me somewhat. And
We have had quite a few
texts.
There
we go. Yep, I thought we might.
And we have spent a lot of time, so we have to rush through the other ones. Yeah, but no, I'm going to read these. Okay, somebody's saying, fluoride is a poison used to kill rats. Somebody else saying,
No.
Isn't it a byproduct of aluminium production?
No. Oh, God, here we go.
Okay, wait.
I've heard all of this.
Somebody else
saying,
it is not a measles epidemic.
Okay.
Somebody else saying, can you mention on air that no trials have ever been done for vaccines using a double-blind placebo saline control group, and maybe we can talk about that next week on air?
Yeah.
It's not a randomized controlled trial. Couldn't be. Somebody else, this one's long. I think naturally occurring fluoride is very different to man-made fluoride that is put into the water.
No, it's not. It's exactly the
It is
same
true.
Thing.
People that live in parts of the world that have high levels of naturally occurring fluoride, calcium fluoride, have better teeth. This is not the same stuff they're putting in the water, sodium fluoride. I think you need to define the difference
fluoride
for listeners.
Fluoride is fluoride. There is absolutely no difference.
Okay.
Fluoride is fluoride. Full stop.
And somebody saying boys are also disproportionately affected live vaccines. Full stops. That is still to be explained by science, but seems to be reoccurring then multiple fields of study, or in multiple fields of study, I guess.
Okay.
Well, lots of texts.
Well, there we go. I knew.
Great.
I knew that would happen. But please, okay, all of you people who've texted in, please
do Ellen a solid.
Just go and have a look at the Science Media Centre, sciencemediacentre.org, I'm pretty sure it is, it's either that or .com, and go and have a look at the expert opinions on this paper and the shortcomings of the science in this paper, okay?
And also, I guess, on that point, Ellen, maybe you can do the text as a solid and go and look into the differences of fluoride, maybe? I know you've said, yeah.
I can say, without a shadow of a doubt, fluoride is fluoride is fluoride.
Okay. Somebody's texting and saying, I agree with your man, the feedback you're receiving is nonsense. I bet they're anti-1080 too. Fucking frustrating. Well, okay.
Okay,
we should talk about Pluto. Let's, because I mean, this is the thing. There is really controversial opinions, and I'm glad that we're getting people messaging in. So thank you, everybody.
Yeah, definitely.
This is the thing, though. We have to have these conversations.
No, we do.
Otherwise, we're speaking to people. We're speaking to each other on this massive spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. I'm going to go look at the Science Media Centre.
Okay.
Didn't know that was a thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, it very much is. It's as I said, it's a very good resource for expert opinion on matters scientific.
But so. Also this point, I mean, I've never heard this, that boys are disproportionately affected by vaccines.
No, I haven't heard that either.
Okay. So yeah. Should we go look? Well, let's look that up. Let's look this up. Let's read about this stuff. But Pluto.
Yes. Okay.
I want to talk about Pluto.
Okay. We can talk briefly about Pluto. So, August 24th, 2006 was a very sad day for the solar system because the number of planets on that day shrunk from 9 to 8. And, you know, I mean, come on, when I was a kid, you had to learn all the planets in order, you know, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, and there were 9 planets. And then these people called the International Astronomical Union, they decided that Pluto wasn't a planet anymore because they came up with 3 rules for something to be called a planet. And the third of those rules basically said that it's not a planet if it doesn't clear the neighborhood around its orbit. And so all of the other planets in the solar system have basically got nothing around them, or nothing very, very close to their particular orbits. You know, Mercury, Venus, Earth, blah, 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 blah. So between Mars and Jupiter, you've got the asteroid belt, so you've got a whole lot of stuff in there, but they're not within the orbits of Jupiter and Mars. However, you go out to Pluto, and then you've got this thing called the Kuiper Belt, and you've got a whole host of similar sort of sized objects out there to Pluto. And so because of that, they said, right, Pluto hasn't cleared its orbit, and so therefore you've got all these other things there that, you know, similar sort of things. And so Pluto's not a planet anymore. And so what they did is they reclassified it as a dwarf planet, okay, along with some other objects in the Kuiper Belt around about the same size as Pluto. So the reason that we're bringing this up is that the NASA administrator, Jim Bridenstone, last week said that, damn it, he thinks that Pluto's a planet. And so this has sort of reignited the debate. And none other than Brian May of Queen has got involved.
Oh, okay. Let's steer away from that, though.
No. Oh. Brian May. He's got a PhD in astrophysics.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, and he agrees?
He's actually qualified to...
to speak on
yes,
this.
Yes, to speak on this. And yes, he agrees. He agrees that Pluto should be a planet. So there you got the administrator of NASA and the guitarist for Queen. You know, what more do you
what
need?
What more do you need?
Yeah, exactly. You know.
Well, I'm interested. I picked up the quote from, and this is, yes, the head of NASA, saying, I'm sticking by that. It's the way I learned it, and I'm committed to it. Now, we have just been discussing...
Yes, okay.
New
so
science.
Blind yes.
New science, yes. New research.
Yes.
You have to give up on things.
Well, yeah, fair point. No. I take what you're saying. Some people would say that these rules that had been implemented by the International Astronomical Union were somewhat arbitrary, maybe.
Exactly. So who do we believe then?
Well, again, the person that brought it in is a big fan of this. He's saying that science is all about classification, and you've got to classify things correctly to make sense of them, okay? You've got your periodic table in chemistry, you've got Linnaeus in biology and your classifications of, you know, your system, your phylus and phylum, genus and blah, 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 you know, all that sort of stuff, blah, 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 blah. And so the same thing should apply to planets. And so he is being very, very staunch and saying, no, Pluto's not a planet. It's a dwarf planet. It's different from the others. And I guess you can sort of see his point. However, between the time when it was declassified as a planet and now, we've had the big thing of the New Horizons space probe go all the way to Pluto and its moon, Charon, or however it's pronounced.
And so there are more signs that it is a planet.
Yeah, well, and that got a lot of people thinking and saying that, you know, this really does have all the hallmarks of a planet. For God's sake, let's just call it a planet. You know, and go back
just
to the way it was.
Just let Pluto be.
Yes.
Okay.
And apparently, there's a new verb in English now to be Plutoed.
Oh.
Apparently, where you sort of get dropped without reason, sort of thing. You know. So.
That is sad to be Plutoed. Okay. Well, we should probably wrap it up unless you want to quickly talk about the mineral.
No, we probably haven't got to. Oh, goodness me, is it the time? Wow, we've been controversial today,
folks.
We have been controversial
on timing as well. Okay, well, let's talk about the mineral in a couple of weeks.
We can do that.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Okay, see ya.
Mind
blowing. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
What an occasion. My friends, the music, the atmosphere. You know what I could go for? An interesting cocktail.
Liquor King Delivery. Everything you need for an interesting cocktail delivered to your door.
Hot dog!
Discover interesting cocktails and more at Liquor King. More than your average bottle store, Liquor King has that little something extra. And now there's free delivery on any order with code BFM. That's free delivery with code BFM. Liquor King. Go to lk.co.nz. Terms and conditions apply.
Northern Bass is back again to suss your New Year's. And with the likes of Fat Freddy's Drop, Friction, Freddie Gibbs and Noisier on the lineup, this year it's absolutely unmissable. If you want to win yourself a double pass with camping to the Southern Hemisphere's best bass festival, then just grab your B-card and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive all this week. Northern Bass, December 29th, 30th and 31st in luscious Mangawhai. Tickets on sale now from northernbass.co.nz.
The 2019 Monster Energy Jossie Wells Invitational. Like nothing else on the world circuit, the best skiers and snowboarders from around the globe picked by New Zealand's own Jossie Wells. 3 days of competition, three different disciplines, all rider judged, and with one hell of a party to finish it off. Fully sick and unmissable, the FOMO is real. The Monster Energy Jossie Wells Invitational, September 9 to the 15th. Go to cadrona.com/JW Invitational.
Wow, music's everywhere. It's like a cloud of art.
Here at 95BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you.
August features Troy Kingi, Yusu, Beak, Blush Juliet and more.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
The Wire.
Yes, welcome back to The Wire, and we've had a few more texts in since Alan has left the studio. Somebody saying, Flat Planet texters, take off the foil hat, guy. Science is your friend. Somebody else saying, fluoride is a neurotoxin and dangerous to your health. I'm wondering if neurotoxin, that sounds really bad and would be seriously damaged by that. And somebody else saying, not pronounce caper. I might have been saying something wrong. Apologies. And somebody else voting in for the top 10. Thank you to you guys. Keep voting. And then finally, when will your science guy address the concerns anti-vaxxers bracket? Gotta love that term for it's a witch hunt mentality. When will your science guy address the concerns anti-vaxxers have instead of just ridiculing them? It seems this is what mainstream news does too. No wonder there is so much confusion and distrust on the issue when both sides are not explained and concerns properly addressed. And that's quite a valid point. So we should probably have those conversations much more in depth. Perhaps that's a project for us guys. What do you think, Will and Two? Should we investigate?
It's very hot at the moment. I'm not sure if I want to touch it. I think I'll leave it to Alan.
This is exciting. I like this.
Okay. All right. Let's move on to our next piece. Helen Clark, former Prime Minister of New Zealand and former Administrator of the United Nations Development Programme, is... Wow, I didn't finish writing that sentence. Okay, that is Helen Clark. If you didn't know, she is the former Prime Minister and former Administrator of the United Nations Development Programme, also part of the Helen Clark Foundation, patron of it, in fact. Today, the Helen Clark Foundation has released a report outlining the reasons for legalising and decriminalising cannabis. The foundation is an independent, non-partisan public policy think tank from Aotearoa and aims to contribute to policy debates on how to achieve a more inclusive, sustainable and peaceful society. The report's release comes in the lead up to the referendum set for next year on whether to decriminalise cannabis, and Clark has spoken about the need for informed debate around the issue. I rang her while she was on her way to a live-streamed conversation with Chloe Swarbrick this morning at AUT, just next door, and started by asking her to explain the findings of the report.
The findings are that the evidence points to legalising and regulating cannabis. It is a drug that is widely judged to be significantly less harmful than either alcohol or tobacco. Both of them are legal. That's an accident of history that cannabis ended up on the other side of the ledger. It's time to put that right. The New Zealand approach, like that of many countries for many years, has been to try to ban it. And yet this is a drug that 80% of us will use at some point in our lifetimes. So banning doesn't work. you're better to get a grip on it, legislate around it, legalise it and regulate supply. I would argue a form of regulation rather like that we have for tobacco, where of course you tax it, you set an age for sale and consumption, you regulate for content, you say on what terms it's available, you don't have any advertising either at point of sale or publicly. There's a lot of ways you can actually get a grip on this.
You mentioned the way that it has been dealt with previously or up until now, and there has been a lot of research showing that, in America, for example, the war on drugs was actually highly racialized. Is that also the case here?
Well, one of the sad things about our country is that the proportion of Māori who are caught up in the criminal justice system, including on cannabis offences, is hugely greater than that of the general population. So there are systemic issues there, and they come up in the drug so-called offending as well.
One of the points in the report is to expunge prior minor cannabis offences from the record. What would this mean?
Well, what it means is if you have a conviction on a cannabis-related offence under the old law, that would be wiped from the record. If you're stuck with a criminal conviction on your record, it can have dire implications. You might be denied entry to the United States of America. You might be denied a job. You might be denied all sorts of things. So it does cast a blight over people's lives, and that's not fair.
Do you think that the country, I suppose, or people are willing to kind of make that shift in terms of going from having this understanding that this is a crime to it now not being a crime?
Well, most people have used it. That's the point. And so do they favour a continuing criminalisation of it, or do they favour actually having the law reflect reality? 80% use. Of course, most people haven't been prosecuted, but anybody could have been. It is disproportionately unjust to Māori, and just for so many reasons, I think New Zealand needs to get this right.
And why is it that your foundation has taken this issue on board, I suppose? How long have you been working on this?
Well, the foundation was set up to work on evidence-based policy and to work in areas where I, myself have a long-standing interest. So one of my major areas of activity since leaving the UN has been to be an active member of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, and that commission does advocate the approach that we're taking. So this is an approach consistent with that.
And just finally, with the referendum being next year, do you think that, what needs to happen in order for us to have a kind of well-reasoned, well-informed debate in time for that referendum?
I think the government will need to be clear on the proposal that it's putting forward. There is a cabinet paper out now, but there are still decisions to be taken about the nature of the regulation which would be proposed. So the Drug Foundation, which is a well-respected body, it will obviously be making the case for yes, and it will be bringing as much expertise as it can out. What I would ask is that, Kiwis actually look at the facts rather than at the rhetoric and mythology around this. Unfortunately, there is a lot of that out there. But in the end, you make an appeal to common sense.
Yeah, and on that common sense, I suppose, because Chloe Swarbrick has been, from the Green Party, been kind of leading this issue, and she's gotten a lot of flack, I suppose, for being younger. People have said, you don't have kids, so therefore you don't have the experience, you don't understand this issue. Have you gotten the same sort of flack?
No, and I think it is important that, people like myself who are senior and have experience come out on this. Chloe can't carry the whole debate on her own. That's unreasonable. She's done a fantastic job to date. You also have very senior ministers like the Minister of Justice, Andrew Little, and the Minister of Health, David Clark, who've come out for this approach of not criminalising cannabis use anymore. So more voices across the political spectrum. I know people across the political parties in New Zealand who are very strongly in favour of this. It's not a left-right issue. It's not a Green versus others issue. It's an issue that says, are we going to put health and social issues at the forefront of our mind or continue this really quite pointless and counterproductive criminalisation?
That was Helen Clark speaking about decriminalisation of cannabis. The Case for Yes report is available on the Helen Clark Foundation website. Paula Bennett, National Party spokesperson for drug reform, said this morning that Clark's argument is flawed. I thought I should mention this. Bennett says people are not actually being prosecuted for marijuana use and cites the recent amendment to the Misuse of Drugs Act made by the current government, where people will no longer be prosecuted for individual use and then it will be dealt with as a health issue. Bennett does support treating it as a health issue, but believes legalization is a different conversation than one about health. What are your thoughts on this? 5395 to text and 309-3879 to call.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
Recent scrutiny surrounding foreign political donations have flared after revelations from the National Party received $150,000 from Chinese billionaire Lang Lin. This large sum has led to fears over foreign influence on New Zealand's political system. While the cap for overseas donations are supposedly set at $1,500, Lin managed to skirt these laws by donating through a New Zealand-based company. Some, such as Victoria University's Dr. Simon Chappell, have called for an outright ban on foreign donations, as well as a cap on domestic ones. I spoke with Dr. Lara Greaves from the University of Auckland about the laws on donating and the unequal amount gifted to right-leaning parties. I started off by asking Dr. Greaves to clarify what the current laws are over foreign donation.
Yeah, so there's a lot of sort of... The rules on this are a little bit complex and a bit confusing, and I think a lot of people just don't, they go, oh, donations, that's something over there, and they just kind of ignore it because it's electoral law and people aren't very into electoral law. So when you actually look at the rules, someone who's classified as a foreign donor can only actually donate up to $1,500 in a given year. So this is more a case of people going, oh, okay, let's find some way to work the rules to get this money through rather than the actual law. It's all within the law, what they've done, but we do actually have a very limited foreign donation thing, although I just recently read that over 100 countries have completely banned foreign donations. So this is more a case of people looking at the law and it saying a certain thing and then people kind of working around it.
So this donation isn't technically illegal. Why is it being labelled as troubling?
Yeah, so people have kind of labelled this, like Ardern's labelled it outside of the spirit of the law, because I think what it comes back to is a little bit of it's going to be xenophobia, right? And we see this is when a lot of, say, Chinese business people donate money. We saw this with the earlier one with Zhang to the National Party and that whole, the Jamie Lee Roth case and that drama. That when someone, when an outside influence, even if the person is actually not outside, they're just perceived as outside, when they donate money, there's often people go, oh, foreign influence, and there's an element of xenophobia in that, firstly. Secondly, I'd say that people, they just don't like the idea of this, and when we go back to that fundamental sort of fairness that people have and that gut kind of feeling of fairness, does this feel fair? People kind of feel as though it doesn't. So I think there's an element of that in there as well.
So private influence over politics occurs overseas, but what is the historical link between money and power in New Zealand? How often does this happen here?
So here we see like a real, and we've seen it over sort of the last, you know, few decades, we've seen National receive a lot higher donations generally than Labor. So if you look at the last election, National got $4.6 million in donations overall, and Labor got $1.6 million in donations. Now, a lot of that hasn't been foreign donors. People generally, when there are the quote-unquote foreign donors, but that tends to be only like a couple of $1,000s, or I think, yeah, last year Labor it was $900. It's not a lot of money that are in this foreign category. But generally, I think there's been this huge imbalance over the years between the amount of money that's gone to right-leaning parties and right-wing parties and that has gone to left-leaning parties. So if you look at ACT, who have one MP, they got $780,000 last election, and the Greens got $850,000, yet they're a lot larger party. So I think a lot of it comes back to actual, like, politics, because we want to keep this fairness and democracy out of politics, right? We want to go back to these sort of fundamental values. But historically, the right has gotten a lot greater amounts of donations, and so that means that from time to time it comes up as quite a sort of large political issue, and especially around the issue of just moving towards state funding rather than having foreign donors or any donors, any businesses, any individual person able to donate money.
Do you know what the laws are surrounding transparency for these donations?
Yeah, so if you donate more than $15,000 in a year, you have to be public, but if it's less than 15,000, then you don't have to. So there's like a big long load of bullet points on the Electoral Commission website that are incredibly confusing, even people that are really into this.
How tight do you think our laws are in preventing foreign interference? Do you think they're good enough, or they really need to be looked at again?
Well, the Justice Select Committee are looking at them at the moment and really trying to figure out exactly what you can do to tighten these laws. The problem is the people that we're talking about are really creative, and they are generally like successful businesses, and we know, or those sort of larger international businesses and stuff. So we know that those people are particularly good at finding their way around laws. I think that they need to be tightened, but that's just a very difficult thing to do, because people will find a way around it. They're sneaky. It's just what these people do.
What do you think the intentions were behind the Lang Lin donation to the National Party?
Yeah, so people have speculated that has been around because it's on behalf of sort of that, like Lang Lin's involved in horse trading and one of those sort of larger horse traders. That's relating to the laws around banning the export of livestock, like live livestock, so that, and those laws, it could have something to do with that. I think that generally, though, it just fundamentally everyone can kind of see this. You go back to, why would someone donate that much money? And we've seen in the past it's been, you know, to get dinner with ministers or to actually have people's ear, and that's, I think, quite threatening to people or kind of suspicious to people.
Dr. Simon Chappell from Victoria University spoke with Radio New Zealand suggesting a cap on domestic donations as well as a complete ban on foreign ones. Do you agree with this? And if not, do you suggest any other kind of reform?
So if you cap the donation, automatically what's going to happen is you're going to have political parties on the right go, but that's now disadvantaging us. And they're going to then cry nanny state, because they're going to go, well, then are you going to go to publicly funded? Then you're going to have to publicly fund up to a point, and the general public are going to go, I don't want my money going to political parties. I don't want my tax dollars going to funding political parties when, say, the health system and other systems need work. So I don't really know what the answer is in all of this. I think that no matter what you do, you're going to get cries of, oh, but they said this, oh, they did that. I do think that, unfortunately, I go back to sort of, for me, the different forms of political participation. And donating money is political participation. And it's political participation that we can't all do. So for a lot of people, they don't have enough money to live day to day, let alone give money, give 1,000, give 30,000, give 100,000 to political parties. And I think that that's fundamentally unfair. And so, like, I mean, as a sort of purist democratic person, I would love to go to a system that's all publicly funded and fair, because, again, businesses are always going to give disproportionately large amounts of money to the right-wing parties, and then they're going to have that advantage. But unfortunately, I don't think that the public will necessarily want to give their tax money to politicians.
Anything else sort of in the general area that you'd like to say about this topic?
I think I'd just probably add as well that, yeah, we've looked at the New Zealand election study, a representative sample of New Zealanders, and only a few percent of people do give money to political parties, whether that's just a small amount. And it does seem to be quite an unequal thing.
That was Dr. Lara Greaves from the University of Auckland speaking to William Boyd. And just on that interview, somebody texted in saying The Emperor's New Clothes by Russell Brand, I'm guessing that's a film, talks about the corruption in politics and banking, etc., worth a watch. And then earlier to Helen Clark's interview, someone saying, I think it shouldn't be legalised because I won't be able to get it as cheap and as easy, lol. True, okay, interesting. I think the point, though, is actually that it's, yeah, it'll be regulated, so it will be, in essence, a much more, yeah, it'll be far more official, I suppose, and that's what you're saying, aren't you? Okay. Somebody else saying, has Dear Science had an in-depth look at 5G and the possible effects on people and animals? If not, can you? We will put that to Alan. And lastly, everyone knows fluoride and vaccines give you a kind of autism that makes you think the world is a sphere. Don't know where that's going, but we'll be back after the break. You're on The Wire.
What? What the hell?
Yeah, it's turned into a bit of a complicated install.
You've tipped out my undies drawer.
Yep.
My kimchi's gone everywhere.
Yeah.
There's a dog in the sink.
That's heat pumps, mate.
Don't leave it up to some cowboy. First Stop AC and Electrical are your first stop for heat pumps. The full range of models, top quality installations from an experienced team of installers. For a warmer, healthier home, First Stop AC and Electrical. Go to firststop.co.nz or call 0800 178 7867. That's 0800 178 7867.
Iconic High Street Boutique Storm is moving to a new location and they're having a relocation sale to celebrate.
From now to September 15th, Storm's High Street store will be packed with samples, seconds, end of line and end of season stock, all at discount prices.
Don't miss this chance to land unique designer garments at a sale price. Don't wait, get in while stocks last. The Storm Relocation Sale, 23 High Street, on now to September 15th.
Interested in 3D modelling, web design, programming, animation or robotics?
Then the Mind Labs Tech Toolbox evening courses are just what you're looking for.
5 courses to choose from. No experience necessary.
Book now at motat.org.nz. Hemp is hitting the mainstream with Burger Fuel's new electric Pooha. Innovative, sustainable, nutritious, limited edition and out now. A nutrient-rich lineup of crumbed hemp and brock bites, puha and cabbage kraut, hemp oil aioli combined with fresh rocket, an ounce of relish and avocado, all sitting in a wholesome organic hemp sourdough bun. 100% locally sourced and 100% vegan, given to Hemptation. The electric puha, available now at Burger Fuel.
Hell yeah! Pixies are coming to New Zealand for the first time since ages ago, and we're lucky enough to be giving away tickets. If you want to be in to win, then just grab your B-card and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive all this week. Pixies, come on Pilgrim, it's Surfer Rosa, live at Spark Arena, Friday, March 6th. Tickets on sale now from livenation.co.nz.
The Wire.
Philanthropy is the desire to promote the welfare of others, especially by the generous donation of money to good causes. Thanks to Wikipedia for that definition. For many organisations and services here in New Zealand, philanthropic funding is the biggest single contributor of non-governmental resources. Public donations, service fees and investment funding make up the rest. A recent report estimates the government underfunds community organisations that it contracts to deliver vital services on its behalf by a considerable and arguably unacceptable margin. The government is funding just under two-thirds of the cost of delivering the services, with 83% of social services providers relying on philanthropic funding to deliver the government's services. In the lead-up to this story, I had no idea just how much of New Zealand services relied on donations just to stay operational. I spoke with Philanthropy NZ Chief Exec Sue McCabe about the recent report that came out. She is a co-founder and trustee of the not-for-profit Community Comms Collective and co-founder and director of social enterprise The Good Registry, and someone I personally thought was obviously very passionate and well-versed when it came to the issue. I started off by asking Sue what the report found.
The report found that essential social services that the government chooses to contract out to community groups to deliver are underfunded by an estimated $630 million a year.
Can you give me some specific examples of what the government is underfunding?
So essential social services cover a wide range of services, but they include things like social workers in schools. So this is an essential service for children and youth who need someone to talk to. Counselling for families where there has been a suicide or potentially some sort of early intervention where families are raising children with a disability and they need some extra support.
And so what role does Philanthropy New Zealand serve in all of that?
The report found that government is funding just under two-thirds of the cost of delivering these core social services, and that the community groups then need to look at how to fund the shortfall. They fund the shortfall through a range of means, for example, going to the public and asking for donations. They might have run businesses on the side. They might have corporate sponsorship. And another way that they're funding it, quite a major way, is they're applying to different philanthropic trusts and grant makers for funding to cover their services.
So why isn't the government funding, basically? Is it because that they use these philanthropic services as a crutch, do you think, or is it because there's not enough room in the budget? What do you think?
This is a long-standing and complex issue. The government has been only part funding social services for some time, and you'd need to ask them why they don't fund social services fully. There is always a lot of financial pressures on government, but the impact of underfunding these services is unacceptable, so the government does need to look at how they can fully fund these costs, because the impact of this underfunding is, you know, staff burnout and not-for-profits, and our most vulnerable New Zealanders sometimes missing out on services that they need to participate fully in society.
And so what kind of roadmap would you give me in terms of, you know, what to do next? So what should the government do next in terms of just like a plan for the rollout of funding?
The report that the social services providers Aotearoa has put out contains a number of recommendations for what needs to happen next in the immediate, medium and longer term. The issue is complex, but a key thing is that the government needs to fully fund these important services. It needs to fund these services like it funds its own government departments, because the services being provided are just as critical. So the next step is for the government to address this in its next government budget. And even before that, we've now been told through this report that there is a group of senior officials in government agencies looking at how to make social services more effective. And we would like to be involved in those discussions, which would see the implementation of one of the recommendations in this report, which is that government needs to involve social service providers in the philanthropic sector around the solutions in order for the system to come right.
Now, it's interesting that you say that you'd like to be more involved. I'm just wondering, what kind of dialogue has the government had with you in the past?
So the philanthropic sector engages with government on a daily basis all around the country. We work really collaboratively and constructively. There are a number of services in other sectors and in the social sector, but, you know, education, health, etc., where there's kind of joint kind of funding between government and philanthropy for important community services. But we need to be talking to government about this at a system level, not about program X or program Y in a particular area, but actually about the system and how to come up with a different kind of funding approach.
Interesting. What do you mean by system level? I'm not sure what that means.
We want to talk to government about the way it funds social services across the board. Yeah. Instead, currently what is happening is that system is not right. The government is funding social services, and then philanthropy and grant makers are kind of picking it up reactively on a program by program basis. And that's putting the burden on the community organisations, who often need to employ extra resource or use volunteers to think, oh, how are we going to come up with this funding shortfall for an essential service? And that's using kind of scarce resource for something that's not actually that helpful.
So what kind of changes would you personally recommend, do you think?
The government needs to think about how it can fully fund the social services that it seeks that the not-for-profit sector deliver on its behalf.
Just before I let you go, Sue, do you have any sort of final thoughts around the topic?
I think that to make sure that you're aware, so Philanthropy New Zealand, we're like a peak body, so we don't give out funding ourselves, but we've got members who give out the funding. So basically, these community groups are applying to a whole range of different organisations for funding, like community trusts, and energy trusts and family foundations, and, you know, there's no guarantee that they get the funding.
But you sort of facilitate that in a way.
Well, what we do is we're like a peak body for the philanthropic sector. So we kind of connect these funders so that, you know, we can advocate on issues like this. You know, we offer professional development for different funders, like we put on a conference, we bring people together, we get together groups of funders that have got a particular interest, like funding the environment or funding youth or funding education, so they kind of know what's going on and they can collaborate with each other rather than working in silos. So that's the type of thing that we do. We don't actually hold funds ourselves.
That's really interesting. All right, well, thank you very, very much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
No worries. Good luck.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for the 4th of September. That was, we just heard from Sue McCabe from the Philanthropic Society, but also thank you to our other guests today, Alan Blackman, Helen Clark, and Dr. Lara Greaves. Thank you to Will and Tu for producing, and thank you to everybody who has gotten in touch with us today. It's been a volley of texts and calls. Thank you. Thank you for listening. Those of you who didn't text in or call, just listen. That's cool. We will be back next week, possibly with more controversial topics. Up next is the 1 to 4. You're listening to 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup. That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95bfm.com/signup.